Hey everyone, and welcome to Between the Creations. My name is Lauren Hook, and each week on the podcast, I and my guest discuss various aspects of theology, Christianity, and the Bible. I'm so glad you've decided to join us. Let's get started. Well, welcome everyone to this week's episode of Between the Creations. It is good to be back with you after taking a few weeks off for the summer. I just needed a break. Being honest with y'all, my listeners, I just needed a break. And so we're back. And guys, I'm super excited this week. We have Mary Jo Sharp, who is an apologist, an author, a professor, a constant learner. She's just delightful. Let me tell you a little bit about Mary Jo. She is a former atheist who came to faith and has experienced kind of Christian culture across the country and the differences that means from kind of the Pacific Northwest and then even like the Bible Belt. So she's kind of been all around the United States learning from different Christian perspectives and kind of taking that all in and then synthesizing it into various books that she has written. She's also an assistant professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University, and she's the founder and director of Confident Christianity Apologetics Ministry. She does a lot of speaking. She has her own podcast, which I will mention in the show notes and everything. But welcome, Mary Jo. It's so good to have you. Do you have anything that you want the listeners to know about you before we are off to the races here?
Thank you, Lauren, for having me. I'm tired just listening to that list. I would say, okay, so something, two unique things that people may not know about me. I'm a saxophonist. I play saxophone. And I like stunt kite flying.
What is that?
So, most people you think of a kite on a string and it just stays up there, right? You know,
yeah.
Like in Mary Poppins. But stunt kite flying, you have usually typically two strings. And so you can make the kite do tricks.
Oh, cool. Okay. So you're not like on the kite, right? You're on the ground. It's not okay. I was envisioning something like parasailing or something where you're like,
so much cooler than what I do, which is just stand on the ground and do neat little tricks with a kite. So.
But hey, I've already learned something. We're not even 60 seconds into you talking and I'm already learning things. So that's awesome. But yes, saxophonist, stunt kite flyer. We cover the gamut on this podcast, y'all. So anyways, Mary Jo is, like I said earlier, she is an apologist and writes a lot about the Christian faith. Now, I'm sure a lot of you listeners know what that means, but in case you don't, totally fine. No big deal. We're going to define some terms here. So Mary Jo, would you kind of just explain, what do we mean when we say apologetics? And kind of what is it that you do kind of with your job and with the classes that you teach? What are you kind of focusing on when we talk about apologetics?
Yeah. So apologetics is a transliterated word, which means it's not English. We just ripped it out of another language. So it's a Greek word, and it's the word apologia in the New Testament, which means defense. So it means to make a case for something. And if you were to go back into some archaic language, lawyers would be considered apologists. So they're making a case. And that's what apologetics in broad form is. And then in Christian apologetics, of course, you're making a case for your hope in God, for why you believe in God. Now, what do I do with that? What do I do? Well, I originally started a blog to defend the resurrection. So I was sharing evidences of the resurrection of Jesus and arguing and debating with that. And then this turned into a ministry, which eventually turned into a professorship. And so what I do in my professorship, one thing I do is I try to basically reproduce myself to train other people in how to make arguments and a case for belief in God in a very relational and winsome way. And then I also help them, just encounter the arguments and work through some of their issues and objections and doubts. So that's basically in short form.
Right. That's awesome. And I think that a lot of people don't realize, well, maybe they do, but the specifics of how many different types of arguments that people who do apologetics professionally or as a professor, how many things that you all talk about and discuss. And I mean, it's not even just on an academic side, part of it's cultural and kind of synthesizing all of these various aspects of just kind of humanity in our daily lives and the reasons that a lot of people are like, yeah, this whole God thing, I'm not really jiving with it at all. And it's kind of just so multifaceted, and it's fascinating to talk yeah. about. So you've recently, not super recently, but one of the things that you've been talking a lot about, just with your writing and all those things, is how a lot of people right now, one of kind of the buzzwords in Christian circles and in churches and stuff, is this idea of deconstruction, and which. And for all intents and purposes, is when you take kind of your beliefs in Christianity and you begin to kind of wonder, do these hold up? Does this make sense? And you, in a sense, deconstruct down to the bedrock, why you believe what you believe. And for a lot of people, specifically millennials, Gen Xers, but really across lots of different generations, more and more people seem to be doing this type of work right now. Mm. More and more people seem to be more comfortable with asking questions. And for a lot of people, especially younger people right now, this idea of deconstruction really seems to, in their minds, only lead to deconversion, only has one outcome, and that is to ultimately leave the church because they found their questions unanswered. But you have spoken some hope into that and said deconstruction does not have to ultimately end in deconversion. So can you just kind of unpack that, lead us through a little bit of some of the reasons why that's the case, and maybe give us a little bit of hope? Because I know a lot of us have questions, have doubts, and it's okay to have them, but there's hope at the end of that as well. And I think a lot of us need to hear some of that, maybe in this season of our lives.
Yeah, definitely. So when I started teaching in apologetics and sharing about like, why am I involved with apologetics? Because I really didn't mean to be involved in this. I actually wanted to be a music teacher and an orchestra conductor. So big change for me. But I talk about how, you know, encountering the church and the people in it, let's put it that way, encountering people in the church and seeing the hypocrisy of professing the Bible to be God's truth and then not at times even attempting to live as though it was true, that really affected me and caused me to have some doubt. And I started to question myself. I wasn't raised in church. I didn't have this as my, you know, it wasn't my world, my culture. So I started to wonder, why do I believe this? Do I have any good reasons? And I think from what I've been paying attention to in deconstruction stories, that's very similar to what people are doing right now, is I don't like what I see in the church. Why do I believe this? And that's actually not a bad question to ask. You know, it's a good question to say, huh, maybe some things aren't jiving with what I think should be there if people really believe in God. So, and believe in the Christian God the way that is described in the Bible. So they're starting to, this whole idea of deconstruction, which is sort of a formal term for picking apart the faith and seeing what's there and why we believe it. That's kind of, a lot of the impetus for doing that is because people are disappointed in their church experiences or in the way that people in the church have been responding to other people groups or, you know, non-churched people or situations in our culture. So that's caught, I want to put that out there because I think, especially the polarization that we've experienced in politics and all sorts of things in our culture right now, it's causing a lot of people to question just very basic things.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So
that's kind of some of the impetus for why this has become, you know, on the forefront of our thought. Now, just in deconstructing, as you quoted a sort of a meme that I put out, which is deconstruction doesn't always lead to deconversion, because that's sort of what you think if you were listening to all of these stories of high-profile Christians that are deconstructing. And I'll say this at front, you know, up front, because I want people to hear it in that it doesn't always end in deconversion, because sometimes picking apart the faith actually helps you to see how it is a cohesive worldview and how it makes sense when you put it back together as you're reconstructing what you believe. What I have found in some of the deconstruction stories is that they pull their faith apart and then they leave everything laying out on the table. And then they start picking and choosing, well, I like that, but I don't like that, but I like this, but I don't. And it doesn't come into anything cohesive. So for me, as I saw that, as I started to doubt and as I started to, because out of my own pain and hurt in the church, I went, wait a minute, the litmus test for the truth of Christianity and of this philosophical framework, this worldview, cannot just be on the behaviors of Christians. Mm. Because I could do that with any belief system. I could say, oh, that doesn't work because these people are horrific, and that doesn't work because these people are horrific, and look how they treat them. So you actually have to get at the what's objectively there. Is there anything true? And you also have to consider, if I leave Christianity, and this was a big one for me, if I walk away from Christianity as the basis of what I believe and how I live my life and how I think about things, what am I walking into? Mm. Because you're not walking into a void. And I think that's what a lot of people think they're doing, is that, well, I'm just leaving. But yeah, you're not just leaving. You're actually going somewhere. You're going to something.
Yeah.
And for me, it was atheism. It was what I would go to. And I realized I did not believe that atheism had a robust philosophical framework for things that I really believed in, like justice and injustice and good and evil and things like that. So at the end of the day, I was like, I can't walk away. I couldn't deconvert because I actually believed Christianity was true. So I think that's a important piece of like what's going on right now.
It really does seem to be, for people that I know who have deconstructed, and in, I think it's good work to deconstruct in various ways. Like I think we should be asking hard questions of ourselves and of the faith that we hold. We should be examining it and kind of turning it over and seeing how we've grown or how we haven't grown. And I think that that's something we talk about on the podcast a lot, is it's okay to have questions. It's okay to deconstruct aspects and kind of figure out, this doesn't seem to work anymore. And why is that? But I think you make a great point that not a lot of people are talking about, honestly. And that is, what are we deconstructing towards? Because I haven't heard a whole lot of people talk about that aspect of it. Said that for you, it's like, well, it's either, for me at this point, either atheism or Christianity, because you can't just not be anything. And yeah, I think that's what a lot of people, especially, younger people seem to think, that you might not have a word for it. You might not have a label for it, right? But you are something. Like, it's, and I think that a lot of people, maybe have the allure of the freedom of not being a specific, religion or a specific belief system. And I think that that's something that's actually really, maybe appealing, of saying, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a Buddhist, I'm not a Hindu, I'm not an atheist or an agnostic, I'm just me. But you still have beliefs about God. Either you don't believe God exists or you do. And so that puts you in some camp. Do you have anything to add to that kind of part of the conversation, or different aspect of that at all?
I think that people conflate leaving a belief with being free. I didn't say that the way that I want to. Let me say it this way. There's a liberation of finally making a choice. And that is what's being conflated with this idea of leaving Christianity. And what I mean by that is, you're not necessarily getting freedom by leaving one faith for another. Yeah. And that, there's the problem, is that when I go to something else, is it actually freeing? And in what way is it freeing? So, like, okay, let's say I go to atheism, where at the base of the universe, everything is happening by chance. So that's actually, I'm not actually free in that. I'm actually being constrained by these things, these external forces that are shaping my life, and by the physiological matter that makes up me. So I'm not actually freeing myself. Freedom actually belongs in a system of thought where you're truly free to make a choice, and you actually have that choice. So if, I didn't mean to confuse with the conflation idea, but I think some people think that there is a liberation in going to something else. And what I want to say is, the liberation is in finally making a choice about something, because you've been struggling for so long. But don't confuse that with actually going to something that frees you up to be a person, your own person, or to have personhood, because not every system believes that you are an individual person with a unique personality.
And exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. And I think that there is freedom in aspects of deconstruction that even I've experienced, where I've said, this aspect of my theology that I've picked up just from church tradition or from just all of like the authors that I've read who are all in this stream that I've just kind of adopted as my own that I never really examined. Let me kind of take that off the shelf, pick it apart, put it back together. That is extremely freeing when you're able again to, like you said, make a choice. Like at the end of the day, I still had to decide. So what do I do with this now that I've kind of looked at it from a different angle or reexamined it or picked it apart? I think that aspect of deconstruction and of self-examination is extremely freeing. But at the end of the day, you still have to make a choice. Like you still have to pick and something.
If you go to something that is not freeing, then you can't say that it is. And I mean, you can say it all day long, but that's the conflation of ideas. I like that the way you're saying this, there is a freedom involved in saying, hey, I have the ability to think these things through and to look at my faith and to say, you know, what is it all about? And I think everybody should actually do that and make faith your own rather than something that you've always done or something that you've become a part of, but you don't really understand. It should be something that you make your own through learning about it.
Yeah. Okay. Let me switch gears a little bit here. I want to talk. So this comes up a lot and I think that you're going to have a lot of wisdom when it comes to this. I talk with a lot of people, who have, and I mean, I myself fall into this category, who have friends and or family members who are not Christians. Some who are vehemently against the Christian faith. And these individuals who are Christians find themselves in this kind of position where a lot of them feel very responsible for the faith of their non-believing friends or family members. And they feel a burden, and rightfully so. We feel a weight of a burden for those who don't know Jesus because we think that Jesus actually can fix what's wrong with the world, right? But they feel this overwhelming burden that if they're not bringing up Jesus or the things of the Christian faith in every single encounter and conversation with their non-believing friends, that they are somehow failing or that they are somehow leaving something up to chance, if I can say it that way. And they feel this burden, but then they're also finding kind of on the flip side of that coin that they're persistence in bringing up Jesus and Christianity constantly in conversation is actually pushing that person away because it doesn't feel like they have a normal, just kind of natural friendship anymore. It feels like it's all about this. And I realize that that's a big concept and lots of different aspects to that, but I would love to talk about that with you because what do we do and how do we have healthy conversations and friendships with people who don't believe what we believe when we feel a burden for them? But we also want to be able to actually go get dinner and just have a normal conversation, maybe where we don't make everything about trying to convert them or where we don't leave feeling like, well, you didn't accept Jesus tonight. I've failed again, you know, or stuff like that. And I mean, there's some, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic here, but I think there's a sentiment that a lot of Christians carry that if I'm not actively doing this at every single turn, then I'm not, something's not right with me. So can we unpack that a little bit and just kind of how do we have these conversations? What do we do in these types of relationships, that you've just seen from your own life and your own experiences and also just from research that you've done even?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to, give an appropriate, theology of who does the saving.
Thank you. Yes. Let's do that.
It is not you.
Yes. Amen.
So for everybody listening, you are free. You don't save people. That is the work of the Holy Spirit. That's his job, not yours. So, I think well-meaning pastors have put phrases into people's mind, like if you don't share Jesus with somebody, they could die tonight and then they would go to hell or whatever. And it's like, wow, that's really, really guilt driven on a person.
You're like, that doesn't smell like Jesus.
Yeah, it actually can stymie them because they're like, oh no, I have to do this right now. And you know, again, the Holy Spirit that will be drawing people to himself, and that's his work. And Jesus even says in John, you know, that nobody comes to God unless he's drawing them, like he's bringing them, calling them. So you are commanded to go and, you know, tell about Jesus, to make disciples. And I think that's a really important thing, is that what does it mean for us to be disciples and how does that relate to our evangelism efforts? Well, I think there's a lot of people that are trying to give to others what they don't have themselves. Mm. They're actually, I was describing this to my husband. I was like, it's like our, you know, we're taking a pie to somebody and evangelism is just like, we're going to add it on top, like whipped cream. Yeah. It's just going to throw Jesus on there. It's not really a part of the pie. It's just something we put on top and hopefully they'll enjoy it. And I don't know, you know, have the whipped cream. And I'm like, that's not how it works. Like Jesus has to be the pie. Like evangelism is, has to be a part of who you are. And so, it's great in the way that Tim Uhlhoff describes this. Mm. He's a psychologist at Biola University, and he writes on how to have good conversations, a book called I Beg to Differ, where he talks about that the gospel has to be deeply woven in your own life and that you have to be attending to yourself personally and growing and becoming an attractive Christian. Now, what we've told people is, oh, the world is offended by the message of Christianity. They'll reject you. They don't want you. But the thing is, if God is drawing people to himself and you are working in concert with God to grow and mature in Christ and become a follower of Jesus yourself, who is deeply discipled and has the gospel, you know, affecting you every day, that's that attractiveness. That's that difference. So I think a lot of times we try to throw evangelism on top of what we already are instead of paying attention to, well, who are we becoming? Are we paying attention to ourselves? Are we the kind of person that sees the world through Christian ideology? Mm-hmm. And like, for me, if you talk to me for very long, we're going to get to God, the Bible, Star Wars, or Lord of the Rings. It just happens. Can't help it. So now some people are like, wow, that's very high and mighty. Can you give me some practical, more practical tips? And so the first thing is that you really need to be the kind of person that enjoys Jesus yourself, right? Mm. That's got to be, he can't be slapped on top of just a totally secular lifestyle that doesn't really, that just kind of checks the time card on religion. Because that's, and then you feel guilty because you know you should be telling people about Jesus. Okay, that's not going to work that way.
Yeah.
So first of all, kind of got to get to know what you believe, why you believe it, and let it soak into your life. Secondly, how you can really greatly minister to people is by actually listening to them. And I think that's one another problem is we're told to go and tell, go and tell. Who have you shared with? Well, how about this? Who have you listened to lately? And what are they telling you? Because my husband and I find that we get into more conversations about God because we are listening people and we are interested in other people. So they notice that we're a safe place to talk about life. And then they start opening up. Well, I have this problem with my father who's aging and becoming, here's an old word, he's becoming surly and and we don't know what to do with him. And you know, like, and it's really a burden on my family. And so then they'll talk about these things and we can minister to them and help them. And that opens up conversation for the deeper things. We've earned their respect to have that conversation.
Yes.
So listening to people, finding where you can communicate, what do you already know? And how can you can use that to talk to people instead of going, wow, I'm so nervous about sharing the right things. Don't worry about that. Listen to what they're saying and find what you already can talk about. And then ask them questions. Instead of saying, oh, I got to share exactly this, say, well, what do you mean by that? You know, where are you getting that from? And have them open up about where they're sourcing their ideas. It's not going to be that clinical,
right?
But just, you know, in conversation, think of a way you can ask them a question about, well, what do you mean? Why do you think that?
Yeah.
And that will help them peel back what they're saying and figure out for themselves, well, why do I think the way I think? And where am I getting my ideas from? And that's really important because that opens up the conversation to, well, I'm a Christian and here's where I get my ideas, right? So I think that's really important. People aren't listening and questioning enough. And I mean, obviously we can all relate to that over the pandemic year. Like, but that's the way you can engage in conversation with your family and friends without being Ned Flanders, like the Simpsons neighbor, this like fiddle-dee-dee, Jesus is everything, you know, and I have to say his name 10 times in a conversation in order for you to get saved. That's actually magic. That is not Christianity.
Right. Very different.
Yeah. So there's not like a formula that we use to get people saved, because that's the work of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. We need to live Christianly in our world and care very deeply for people like Jesus does. And as we get to know them, we'll find those points where we can speak into their life, where they're inviting us in to speak into their life.
I get this sense from a lot of people that I talk to who are intimidated about sharing their faith, who are intimidated about having spiritual type of conversations with other people, that they have somehow been convinced, or convinced themselves, or a combination of those two things, that they need to be able to explain and defend against like all kinds of things. Like they're like, if I don't have an explanation, like the cosmological and ontological argument, and like arguments from culture, and arguments about like, I need to know Islam better than any Muslim ever. And I need to know, like, how do we help people take the pressure off? Because I think that either we as the church have done a bad job of putting pressure on our people, or we as church members have put pressure on ourselves and said, if I don't understand those arguments and these other world religions and atheism and agnosticism, then how on earth am I going to have a conversation? Because if I don't have a right answer right now in this moment, this person is going to walk away from the Lord. And we've put this false sense of responsibility on ourselves, but how do we help people take the pressure off of the sheer amount of knowledge that a lot of people think they need to have in order to have conversations about Christianity?
Yeah, that is a great question, because I did start out by saying you kind of need to know what you believe. So one of the things that I tell people is don't try to conquer all of the apologetics arguments. Just go after whatever's right in front of you. Mm-hmm. So that could be that you have a son that has a question, like he's really hung up on this particular question from science, or he's really hung up on this particular issue with evil in the world, you know, and how can God be good when there's evil? Okay. So fine. Or maybe it's your own question. You have one thing that's been bugging you more so than everything else. Focus there, because you already have a desire for that to be answered. So instead of trying to answer everybody's everything, because you can't, let's do another theology of knowledge. Like we'll do that. You can never know everything. You are not God. So be released from that.
Take it off.
Yeah, it's gone. So there's one who knows everything, and it's not us, you know, it's not any of us. So you are allowed to fail in your knowledge, because you're human. You're allowed to have a conversation where you feel like you failed. But I always tell people, well, you're learning, and God knows you're learning. And what he wants is a willing heart.
Yes.
Somebody who's humble and in humility will approach others, not in arrogance. He doesn't want a person who thinks they got it all together, who's just going to tell everybody what to believe, right? So give yourself some space to learn. You get a whole lifetime to learn about God, and there's so many things, and you'll never get to it all. So find the one thing that's really in front of you. What is it? Is there somebody asking you a question? Did something stump you and it's bothering you? Go for that one thing.
Yeah.
And then as you learn about that, you'll see how it applies to other things. So like if you do the problem of evil, you say, well, how can God be good when there's so much evil in the world? As you investigate that, you're going to notice how it applies to atheism, how it applies to Islam, how it applies to Hinduism. Like you're going to start to notice it applies to everything.
Yes.
So whatever it is that's in front of you, do that first.
Let me ask you, this is kind of a follow-up question to that. Obviously, you are as a profession, you do a lot of the different things. So you are talking about the scientific and arguments, and you are talking about different religions and stuff. But we talked a little bit offline about you're working on a PhD and stuff. So what is, if you had to pick the one thing, like what is your one thing, obviously knowing that you have a lot of them on the sides as well, but what's kind of your, like, this is the thing that's, I just love studying the most, and it interests me the most, and this is what I love talking about. Are you able to kind of narrow that down at all? Like what would that be for you?
Yeah, I am. My first love is theodicy, so the problem of evil, and everywhere in which it applies. Like recently, applying it to how we don't understand the nature of God in some ways because we don't know how to enjoy Him. So we're always looking at don't, but we don't understand what the do's are for. So, yes. And that's a stretch from the problem of evil, but it gets there. So the problem of evil, and then the second love would be epistemology, how we know what we know, and are we justified in holding those beliefs?
Yeah.
Because that's going to get at the basis of everything. And so that relates over to my PhD, where I'm doing work in epistemology.
That's awesome. Okay. So this was get ready, buckle up. This was not a question that I sent you beforehand, but I think that listeners would find this really interesting. So you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, you play saxophone, you wanted to go into music, you wanted to have, you thought you were going to have this whole other path and career in life. And yet here you are, you're teaching at the collegiate level and the master's level for people, you're working on a PhD, you're doing all this very academic writing research stuff. How? Like what happened there? Because I think I talk to so many people who are experiencing their own version of what you kind of have described, that what happened in your life. They're like, I started off over here, and now I'm way over here in left field, and I kind of like it, but it's also kind of terrifying, and I'm trying to find Jesus in the process of this, but it's really scary. So kind of what happened there, and how has that played into your understanding of God in your life?
Yeah. So I alluded to it at the beginning in that, and I actually talked a little bit about it, and it's that I didn't grow up Christian. And so I came into Christianity, due to things that I saw that were drawing me, like the beauty of God and, his goodness and truth. And then I get into the church and I find a lot of that lacking, which causes me, I mean, not just lacking, I don't want to be like trite about it. It was years of observing believers and starting to say, hey, nobody believes, I don't think anybody really believes this. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a few people that I've encountered that are amazing, but so I start to peel, you know, apart my own faith and say, huh, is there anything I can hold on to here? What's real? I got it to a point where I didn't want Christianity to be true because I wanted to return to my former lifestyle. So I actually picked it apart. And then as I'm picking it apart, I'm starting to also reconstruct it. And then I said, oh, wow, this is actually more coherent and cohesive than I ever imagined. And I bet if I have these questions about my faith, these doubts, I bet other people do too.
Yeah.
Even though I'd never heard them talking about it in the church, because church life for me was always just teaching on the Bible as if it were already true. So I thought, man, I should probably teach this in my local church. And that's sort of how I got started, was I just said, hey, I did a survey of my local church. If I were to talk on any number of these subjects, which ones would you all be interested in? And I formed a class. And then I found a degree in apologetics, and I meant to go, I was actively searching for a master's in music education so I could teach at the college level in music.
Yeah.
When I saw the apologetics degree, it was one of the first times in my life, other than when I met my husband, that I knew right away I was going to do that. Like I was going to be in the, like when I met my husband, I knew right away I was going to marry him. When I saw the apologetics degree, I knew right away I was going to do the apologetics degree. And so that's sort of how I got here. There was a challenge in my degree program to do a blog where you publicly defended the resurrection. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And I hated the idea of being a public Christian. For one, I grew up in a part of the country where religion was not, you know, we weren't culturally Christian.
Yeah.
The Pacific Northwest. And religion was private. So you sort of keep that to yourself. You believe what you want, but keep it to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I just, oh no, I'm not doing that. So I ended up doing it. Instead of that, there was an option to do a private conversation with a person one-on-one about the evidence of the resurrection. I did that. And then it bugged me and it bugged me and it bugged me that I would not publicly profess my Christianity on the blog. Cause I didn't want that kind of attention. I didn't want people to argue with me. I didn't want that. And so it just bugged me so much that eventually I put up a blog. I gave in. I was like, fine.
You're like,
I'm going to do this.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, fine, I'm going to do it. And wow, don't you know, within like a half year of putting up that blog, I was being asked to write a book and do just speak at events. And so it was, and it's not about like how it happened. It was more like, I feel like I finally gave in and was obedient to what God, what the Holy Spirit was sort of dragging me through the mud for, like, come on. And I was like, all right. So that's how I got from band teacher in the public schools to being a professor, was through this path of doubt and then running away from God, which I like to do, and then finally giving up and saying, I'll do what you want me to.
Yeah. So as a writer, speaker, you travel a lot, you teach a lot of students. So you have a lot of conversations and hear a lot of people's experiences, I'm sure, with culture and apologetics and stuff like that. What is maybe one to three things, however you want to, you know, hash it out or whatever, that you consistently find yourself in the classroom or in a Q&A session or something having to correct? Maybe it's how we define terms, or maybe it's this long held belief that a lot of people come to Christianity or come to apologetics with. What is something, or maybe, you know, maybe two things that you find yourself as a teacher and as a speaker kind of constantly having to help people reframe or correct? And I realized I didn't give you that question up front, so if you need to take a minute,
that's all right.
It's totally fine. But I just, it popped into my brain and I was like, I wonder what she would say to that is something that maybe we all are doing these things and it's like, oh, that'd be good to know from someone who sees a lot of it.
So one of the phrases I get a lot is when somebody's asking me a question after a conference and they say, I have a husband or a son or a daughter, and they'll say this next phrase. Well, two phrases. They are so smart and they know the Bible. Like backwards and forth, they know the Bible. And that, it's sort of a, it's a word for me, like, that makes me pay attention, because I don't think I know the Bible well. Like, I don't know the Bible. Like, I just can spend my whole life learning about it and still say, man, there's some things I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people are walking away from a Christianity that has been taught to them in their church, but not from the Bible and the 2000 years worth of, you know, commentary and scholarly work on it and fellowship amongst the church worldwide. They're walking away from a single interpretation in their church and a single outworking of it
local
church.
Oh, that'll preach. So, yes. Oh, so, yeah, yes.
I try not to be, you know, snotty about
right.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that's what's happening. And because there's no way at like 18 or 22, you know the Bible. Mm-hmm. You probably know what your youth minister and the children's director and your pastor taught you. And that's limited. It's very limited to them. So not that they're not doing, you know, a good job, but it's just limited.
Yeah. You're getting, and even if you read a few academic books, you're still getting, you have, it's not that you haven't tried. It's that when you're 18, you haven't lived enough life. You haven't had enough time to read more expansively, you know, like most of us haven't at 18. Most of us haven't at 45 or 55, you know, it's like, no, that's a good point.
Then, I do hear a lot of questions, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, and I'm going to say it again. A lot of the questions I get from students when I do student camps, especially when I speak on the problem of evil, come out of, they're not saying it this way, but I think this is the heart that it's coming from. They do not know how to enjoy God or what that's for at all. They don't know anything about how I'm supposed to have this relationship with God and what kind of pleasure it's supposed to bring me in any way. I mean, maybe in some ways, like he answers prayer or he's always with you, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
So they don't know, like, when you get a really good aesthetic experience, that there's a joy that it's supposed to bring you, that, and a beauty that reflects God himself and is supposed to draw you to him. Or if you enjoy a really good artistically, like visually artistic movie, well, there's a beautiful God that's at the, you know, creation of all beauty. So they don't understand that, how to give thanks and enjoy and be in relationship. That is the other thing. I mean, there's a lot of things I'd like to say, but I think, like, those are the two things that are on my mind.
No, those are good. That's, I think that is food for thought for a lot of us, because I think you're exactly right. We don't, as a whole, really know, especially in certain traditions. I think maybe other traditions do this a little bit better, but specifically kind of Southern Bible Belt evangelical, God bless us, we just don't know how to enjoy God, because a lot of it is, you know, don't, or, you know, this is bad, bad, bad. And there's not a lot of highlight of, like you said, the aesthetics of beauty and what that can mean for us. So, man, I think that's some really good food for thought for us as we move throughout the week and stuff. That's helpful. Yeah. And I think to go back to what you said about the people who are like, you know, I have this family member or this kid who knows the Bible. I think what a lot of people, when they say that, what they mean is they are really quick to give a response, and I don't know how to respond back to it because they have this verse memorized that kind of out of context disproves something about what I'm trying to prove to them about the faith. And so what do I do with that? And again, this, I think we've talked about it kind of at the top of the podcast. Like we have to know what we believe. Like there is a call to responsibility, that I think sometimes that Christians have avoided maybe in different ways for a long time. We kind of are like, I just go to church on Sundays and go to my job 9 to 5. And that's kind of what I do. And we've avoided the responsibility. And it's a joyful responsibility, but it's a responsibility to do some work. And I think that we don't like to hear that sometimes, that maybe you need to read a book occasionally or listen to a different podcast that really unpacks, this idea, or maybe have an uncomfortable conversation every once in a while. And, I think there's a call for us in that to be uncomfortable sometimes, which we don't like.
Yeah. That's a 1 Peter 3:15 passage. Yes. He's speaking to a group of persecuted Christians, and he says, but in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord. And part of doing that is to always be prepared to give the apologia, the defense of the reason of your hope.
Yeah.
Right. So there's no room for like, well, you know, I don't really, that's not my thing. You're told to do that. And Paul praises the Bereans in Acts 17, because when he preached to them, they didn't just go like, wow, that was awesome, pastor, high five. They went and checked it out to see if what he was telling them was true. And he's praising them for that. So, you know, Luke's telling us about like, hey, you guys, you should be checking these things out. And then Paul actually says, 1 Thessalonians 5:21, to test everything and hold on to the good. And he's not just talking about culture, folks, because the context is in the church.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a church, and there's prophecies that are being given. And so he said, test everything, hold on to the good.
Give a reason for the hope, not for your anger, not for your disparity, not for your frustration with the world, not for, you know, your whatever, your disgruntlement, but for your hope. And I think that's a great call to action for us, and a great place to kind of wrap up our conversation. Thanks so much, Mary Jo. This was great. It just really helpful, thanks. Practical kind of things for us to think about. So I appreciate your time and your heart, and God bless you in your ministry. Y'all, I'm going to tag Mary Jo's Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff in the show notes. You can also, I'll link Confident Christianity. Go check out her website. Go check out stuff. If you are on staff at a church and need someone to come speak, I've heard her teach in person. She does a great job. She is more than willing, I'm sure, with scheduling permitting, to book something in the future with you as she is able, and as things kind of open back up. But yeah, thanks again. And God bless, listeners. I'll be back next week with another great episode. So until then, stay safe, and we'll be back later. Thanks for joining me this week. It's a huge help when you like, rate, and subscribe to Between the Creations wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook for news about upcoming episodes. You can find out more about the podcast, submit topics you'd like me to cover on an episode, or even ask me to speak at your event at laurianhook.com.